signal strength indicator saying that there was a beautiful Channel 25 present. And by the way, it is the identification of Channel 25, which really is on RF frequency 24. Complicated set of reasons why. However, us with the slightly older, one-year-old digital television converters, were getting nothing but a blank screen. I brought this to the attention of Eric, who called up the appropriate authorities, said the right words to them, and within an hour, the problem got corrected. You might want to give us a couple of words as to what magic you had to say in order for the person on the other end to understand the problem and correct it, so that the rest of us who watch over-the-air television on Channel 25 were able to get reception again. What actually took place there, Eric? And thank you for that service that you provided. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, first of all, I mean, you're alerting me, and I kind of could have dealt with it sooner, but I wanted to look at a stream analyzer, which was at work, before I went and called Mr. Kim, by the way, who was the chief engineer of Channel 25, or rather, RF 24, but branded Channel 25. And he was walking around, and at the time that I called him, they were scratching their head. They sort of knew about the problem, but I made a couple of suggestions to him, and then magically it all started working again. Let me explain to you what actually happened, why some receivers were able to see it and others weren't, and the reason why he really didn't know that the problem was happening until we called them is that most of the time the broadcasters provide cable systems with a fiber feed, all right? And they don't necessarily take an over-the-air feed. But some of the cable systems taken over the air feed. But now, here comes a little tricky part. Cable systems have a head unit, which you provide them with specific instructions in terms of where your picture and your sound information is. And what we essentially do is those head-end receivers are basically dumb, and what we do is we give them a specific set of instructions to extract those streams. And the reason for that is they don't want the guide information, they don't want the identifying stuff, they don't want the data that you might be sending. Let me let it drop. And the reason for that is rather complicated. It has to do with FCC rules and what cable systems are willing to pay for. And actually, in most cases, most people don't realize that TV stations pay the cable companies or somebody to get their signal to them. So, let's start from the beginning. A digital television signal is not just an RF signal, like in the sense of it being analog before digital, where is it? You had a bunch of RF that was associated with picture, and another actual separate transmitter in most cases that had the sound. You had an AM transmitter for the picture, an FM transmitter for the sound. You diplexed them together, you mixed them, you combined them, and what you did was you wound up having two transmitters going into one antenna, one transmitting the picture part, and actually the lower sideband was cut off at about 1.2 megahertz. And you had the sound part, which was an FM signal that was transmitted 4.5 megahertz above the picture carrier. So, the sound information was FM, the picture information was AM. Now comes the digital world. Let me let it drop. Okay, in the digital world, we actually have a rather complex RF carrier, whereas you can think of it. No, it doesn't have to be 8BSB. It could be BPSK or QPSK, which is a rather simple method of transmission, or for those of you that know about RIDI and not necessarily PSK21, but other forms of basic CW, really, where you can transmit information by putting a carrier on and making that equivalent to the value of 1 and turning the carrier off and making that equivalent to the value of 0. We use more complex systems than that because we want to know when it's really 0. We want to know when it's really 1. We also want to make some error corrections as stuff goes along the way. But let's just start with the basic 1 and 0 because in the end, the signal itself that has the picture and the sound is simply a string of ones and zeros. And they happen very quickly. Actually, they happen quickly at the rate of 19.39 million times a second, or 19.39 megabits a second. You're getting strings of ones and zeros, and the way they're packaged has meaning. And what we do, if you are familiar with Ethernet or the way your computer operates, we have predefined things called packets, or even in packet radio. We have packets, and in packet radio, one of the things that's transmitted in packet radio is your call sign. So you might be K2RW-1, and actually the first frame of information would be a packet that is, I don't remember how many bytes it is, but in the digital world, the headers are 188 bytes of data. Okay, so the packets themselves are 188 bytes of information wide, with, I think, an AX25, it's, 2 8-bit bytes. So it's a 16-bit word that comes out. And that is an identifying packet. Now, what happens is, you get this, what am I hearing? Alright, I'm listening to the machine out east. These packets now have definitions. Let's say the first packet is the number 1. And that might actually mean that the next 10 packets of data that follow is going to be station identification information. And we have another address packet with the number 2. And that might mean that the next 10 packets of information is channel information or guide information. And then actually in hex, the packet that is associated with the first stream of video would be a hex number 31. So you have this address header 31, and then the next 512 packets of data will actually have picture information in it. And then will come a packet, a hex number of 34, and the next 256 packets of data, each one being 188 bytes apiece, will have sound information in it. So it is really just this continuous stream of ones and zeros that are being sent, which have this intelligence in it. Alright, so now I get to the channel 25 part. Let me let it drop. There are specific packets in digital television that are very important to the receivers. And in the very beginning, there's this protocol that was created by the ATSC, or the American Television Standards Committee, and it has a very stringent set of rules which the receiver has to follow in order to decode this stuff. Oh, by the way, you could, in essence, put together a very long shift register and shift this stuff into it, and out of the outputs of the shift register would come video and audio and data and ID and all this stuff, if you looked at it as one long continuous string. We don't do that because it's a variable length, but that actually can be done with things like time code and other things that are sent that have a very specific data order that happens repetitively and continuously. But in the ATSC paradigm, there's a couple of really important identifiers. One is called a PAT, or a program address table. And in that 188-byte packet, contains the information that this is Channel 25-1, and we also have Channel 25-2. And it says that Channel 25-1 is associated with PID number, or program ID number, 31, which would be the first video. And that Channel 25-2 would be associated with PID number 41, which is the traffic camera video. That was missing from the stream. It was actually sending out the PAT packet, but it was empty. You know, the drop. Now, we also have another really important packet that's sent out, and that one is called the PMT, or the Program Management Table. And within the Program Management Table is another table called the TVCT, or the Television Channel Table, which now associates those streams with the RF channel. That was not even being transmitted. But the things that were being transmitted, which receivers which did not follow the ATSC paradigm exactly, just like the cable head end receivers, knew that there was something at PID 31, and because PID 31 is usually always associated with video, it would extract that, and you would see the picture. And it knows that PID 34 is always associated with audio, and it would extract that, and you would hear the sound. Had those receivers that were working been completely reset, and they did a channel search, then they would lose the channel 25. But because those things were already in the table, they knew how to decode the picture. And also, the other thing that was missing from this stream, PID 31 in this first packet actually has an identifier that says this is video, and PID 34 has an identifier that says this is audio. Those were missing. So the receivers that really follow the rules couldn't pick it up, but you saw there was lots of RF. Now, due to that fact, why did this happen? Okay, there's a device in the TV station called an encoder, a multiplexer, and an exciter, which actually feeds the transmitter. We knew that the exciter part was working because it was making the 8 VSB and it was sending this data, including the data that was missing. It just didn't send because it was missing. And the device that actually makes the video and audio stream is called the encoder. That makes the MPEG-2 signal that becomes the picture and sound. So we knew that was working. And then we have something in the middle called a multiplexer that actually interleaves and puts together the two different channels of MPEG, video, and audio. So that way you wind up with a 25-1 and 25-2. That was not working properly because not only does it multiplex those streams together to make the final stream, which is called a transport stream, but it also puts that addressing information in there. Those address headers, those are the things that tell the TV set what it's getting. And as I said to Mr. Kim, reboot the bloody thing. Did that, and the whole thing started working. All right, Dick, that's my long-winded story. K2RW, K2J.
Well done. Very successful operation there, Eric. What's your guess that happened? A glitch happened in that computer that did the interleaving, and it decided to stop sending that particular information? It wasn't properly rebooted or developed a worm or a virus or whatever? What's your best guess as to how it happened? And my guess is you have an analysis tool which allow you to look at those headers, and you visually saw the missing information, and therefore you were able to tell Mr. Kim exactly what was not there in the over-the-air broadcast. Is that approximately true? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, that's why I didn't call him over the weekend. I wanted to look at my stream analyzer to see what was there, what wasn't there, so I'm not talking through my hat. Usually when I say something, I want to know what I'm talking about before I start talking. You know, I've had too many years of people talking out of the sides of their mouth and having to deal with it, and I don't want to be perceived as one of those people. Well, let me give you a couple of theories on what happened, because I have similar kinds of problems, and they're using a very specific manufacturer. Their encoding equipment and their multiplexers made by a company called Hamburg. The stuff that I use is made by Harmonix. Completely different design, completely different philosophy. My PSIP generator is actually made by a company called Tri-Vini, which also makes the stream analyzer that I use. And what Channel 25 is using is not, is all Tanberg gear. So different manufacturer, different people, different software, you know, a whole different ball of wax, but the end result is supposed to be the same. I'm going to go up. Here we're talking about stuff that's running the bit rates. The clock frequencies of the bits, bit rates themselves in the stream tend to be in the 9 nanosecond range, right? So we're using FPGAs to do a lot of this construction. The software that is supposed to every 300 milliseconds put out some of this information is driven by usually a micro or, you know, maybe even a Pentium chip. Not necessarily a whole computer. Whereas another computer will be talking to that, which might be a Windows-based machine that has a human interface that connects to it. Well, we're talking about computers, driving computers, driving computers, driving computers to make this process work. And all it takes is one cosmic particle that upsets the whole shebang. As we get away from stuff that's simple, the rate of failures have a tendency to increase. So, why? I mean, they have a lot of hours that the thing worked perfectly. Why all of a sudden did it stop working perfectly? Is it on an impure power supply? Did a cosmic ray or some gamma rays hit the chip and cause one single bit to change its state? Take a guess.
Fantastic. Of a much, much lower priority. I also have to report when it comes to over-the-air broadcast, branding Channel 11 almost never has electronic programming guide. It's just missing information, you know, unavailable. And branding Channel 55 has for a couple of weeks now been sending out a electronic programming guide that just says Digital TV Program 1265. And the next half hour is Digital TV Program 1266, 1267, and so on. No real information there. And so to have the electronic program, is that my answer? Yeah, go ahead.
All right, you'll notice that Channel 13 has a really good programming guide, as does Channel 4 and Channel 2. We're talking about a box that, in the case of my station, it's called the Vini PSIP generator. That actually feeds into the multiplexer. That's a $35,000-$40,000 box. Mm-hmm. Basically, what it does, every TV station has a traffic department, and they have some sort of traffic program. In our case, we use a program called ProTrack. And what ProTrack does is it takes the schedule that's put together by the traffic department and turns that into an XML. The XML is sent to the Tri-Vini, I'm trying to think of the name of it, has a profile. It sends this XML file into the profile. That, in turn, takes that information, turns that into stream information, and inserts in the multiplexer something called EIT, or Extended Information Table, which is part of the EPG, or the Electronic Program Guide, acronym City. Depending upon how much money the TV station has, in the case of Channel 11, because they're Tribune, they're kind of in Chapter 11 at the moment, Channel 11, Chapter 11. So it's the choice of the TV station. Are you going to spend that $30,000 or $40,000 to provide the guide? The guide is not an FCC requirement. This is something to make your customers happy. So you will find that other stations that don't have the money for that stuff aren't going to do it.
when it comes to analyzing the Channel 25 problem of last week, you used your stream analyzer. Out of curiosity, what brand name and roughly how expensive is a stream analyzer? And what percentage of the broadcast stations do you think own such a thing, Eric? Go ahead.
All right, now in the world of test equipment, that's a whole other game. For example, when we put our transmitter together at the World Trade Center, when it was still standing, we were able to analyze the APS-B signal and measure its parameters. We used something called an RFA-300, which Tektronix manufactured. That device was, I think it was around $46,000 or $48,000. Hewlett-Packard made a better device, which not only did APS-B, COFDM and various different forms of QAM, and that was about an $80,000 box. What I used to measure the stream was an old device which kind of had some software errors. It's a Triveni stream analyzer. At the time that it was sold, it was about a $30,000 box. They have since come out with newer and better. And previous to that, I had a Sencor, you know that name, a Sencor stream analyzer, which was in a $20,000 range. Now, I could actually go and buy a really cheap stream analyzer for about $1,000, which is a little USB plug-in and software to go into your laptop. So, you know, prices have since come down, but the really high-quality stuff is still in the, you know, the $10,000 to $30,000 range. There's a company, let me just drop. There's a company called MSI, or Modulation Sciences Incorporated. My buddy Eric Small, by the way, who used to be the chief engineer of WORFM in the 70s and 60s, 70s, and 80s. He, with Bob Orban, actually started Orban, Orban sound processors. Any of you folks who know anything about FM broadcasting, he split off from Orban many years ago and came up with his own product, which actually can compete with Bob Orban's stuff. But anyway, he for years made modulators for FM radio transmitters. And as we got into this digital television stuff, he said, well, you know, I'll make a box that will be adequate for you to make measurements with. It's not going to cost $40,000. He sells it for $9,000. So there's that whole kind of range in terms of test equipment. And to a certain extent, you get what you pay for. The latest Agilent stream analyzer, which is equivalent to the $80,000 box that everybody's using now, there's a little box which costs $11,000, and the software runs on your laptop, and it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Okay.
Are there FCC requirements to use something like a stream analyzer to analyze the stream periodically that is being broadcast? Is there an FCC requirement for that, Eric?
No, there is not. The only FCC requirement is to make sure that your skirts are, you know, in the 45 to 55 dB range, that your mass filter is doing its job, that the pilot is somewhere near the proper frequency, and that what you call 100% power is what your transmitter is doing. Those are the requirements.
So in other words, in theory, you can be sending out a signal that the majority of the currently available television ATSC converters might not be able to get picture and sound out of it, and yet you would still be fulfilling the requirements, even though you're not satisfying an audience. I think that's almost what you told me. Go ahead.
That's exactly what I told you. Actually, the guy who invented the system, we've spoken about Gary, he actually is still going to the FCC to try and teach them about it, okay?
Yeah, he's mentioning Gary Spagnoli, the guy who invented this whole digital modulation technique of 8VSB. And Eric and I both own some documents that are about 4 inches thick that explain his theory of operation with lots of diagrams and lots of displayed graphs of what the spectrum should look like and what the data stream should look like and whatever. You're telling me the guy who invented it is teaching the regulatory people what they are regulating. Is that what you're telling me, Eric?
Yeah, that's precisely it. By the way, Gary is not the sole inventor. He's one of many people, but he's the face of the whole thing because he's got the understanding of everything, whereas a lot of the other folks have their own individual pieces in it. I mean, it's all developed by the ATSC in terms of the standards, but the actual method of transmission came from Zenith, which is LG at this point. And you know what LG stands for, don't you?
No, you're going to tell me. Also, on the few times that you have met Gary, tell me, is he a real nerd type? Or what is Gary like? Go ahead.
Well, if I were going to describe it accurately, I can't say it on the radio, but he's a real load of fun, I'll tell you. He's a really cool guy.
Okay. I think you're telling me he's one of these 160 IQ people who probably talks 150 words a minute, and not always is he understood when he's talking to you. Is that somewhat true?
I think you would have a very good time with him, Dick.
Uh-oh. I'm afraid to ask what that means. By the way, a few transmissions ago, you talked about digital signal processing, 16... it sounded like you were saying 16 bits is easy, 24-bit A to D converters. You said that, and I'm having a little trouble with that, because 24 bits would be a ratio of 16.7 million to 1. I'm having a little trouble believing that you get enough accuracy out of a A to D and D to A to have a ratio of 64 million. Run that by again, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's time to readjust your thinking, Dick, okay? If we want to do a traditional A to D, now traditional A to D, you can think of it as a ladder of resistors, okay, which has a reference voltage stuck at one end, and it's connected to ground at the other, okay? And in between those individual resistors is a comparator. And each one of those comparators gets combined down and actually becomes a word. Now, there's a lot of different kind of coatings. Now, remember we were talking about painted on resistors and substrates and laser trimming and being accurate? That's one method, okay? And if you want a 64-bit A to D converter, no problem. Actually, we've had them since the late 60s, 70s. They're kind of expensive. I'll give you an example. There was a company called Soundstream in the 70s and 80s, late 70s and 80s. If you look at the back of any of really fine orchestral recordings on CDs, you might find that they were recorded on Soundstream equipment. Let me move this up. Soundstreams were actually 19-track Kennedy drives in those days. And Soundstream A to D converters were 24 bits wide at that point. Alright? And that is a very traditional A to D converter. The types of A to D converters today that will do 128 bits are what we call successive approximation register A to D converters. What we essentially do is we take a comparator, and we actually take a D to A converter, which is another kind of ladder. There's multiple different kinds of it, where we'll actually take a sample, put a reference voltage into one side of the comparator, and successively step until we get the comparator to fire on that sample. And we can do that with the kind of accuracy that gets to 128 and 256 bits. And we can do that in sample times of a nanosecond and less at today, if you want to pay for it. So, change your thinking.
But that successive approximation process, the good news is it gives you the bits of accuracy you're talking about. The bad news is there's a whole lot of steps for a single accurate conversion. I'm having trouble believing you can get that number of bits simultaneous with, let me pick a number, 300 million conversions per second. I think there's a conflict of interest on bits of accuracy versus rate of final converted analog to digital signal output. Over to you, Eric.
I didn't say that the actual sample was a nanosecond or less. Okay, but the conversion, the complete conversion can happen in a nanosecond. You might think that there's a conflict, but I can show you quite a number of FPGAs made by Xilinx and Altera that operate in the 10 gigabit clock range, or the 10 gigacycle clock range, where we're doing DSP calculations on video. For example, if your satellite receiver that has encryption in it. Okay, each one of those samples, which is, each one of those samples is 27 nanoseconds for each sample of video, if we're talking about high definition. And we may be doing several hundred calculations on each one of those numbers that come by. Now, I'm not talking in the encryption, I'm not talking like a DSP where you're doing simply a multiply and add. You know, we're talking about doing multiplies, divisions, adds, and subtracts to take a 128-bit encryption key and de-encrypt the incoming stream. So, the speeds are there, Dick.
Okay, when it comes to speed, you and I have just discussed that. When it comes to accuracy, by way of the successive approximation, you've convinced me that that can happen. But there's another limit that Mother Nature has for you. If I had a 24-bit analog-to-digital converter, and if the analog signal going in was not 80 decibels of signal-to-noise ratio, I'm wasting my time. In theory, a 24-bit is capable of a minimum of 72 decibels of dynamic range between the LSB and the MSB. So to use a zillion bits of information of a digital signal as the intermediate step in the logic, in the digital logic of a computer program.
I know where you're going.
Go for it.
Okay. I guess really the best thing that we're able to do at this point in terms of what the whole dynamic range is if you want to think of it in terms of an analog form, is I think what is it? Now I'm not gonna be saying the right things here because I don't remember exactly what it is. It is I think the noise floor of some of this stuff now is like
man's gotta know his limitations.
-116 or -120 dBm. If you wanna equate it in that fashion. Yes. There is a lot of problems when we get into the really big words because we have noise, we have other things that get in the way, and the dynamic range between, say, 0 and 1 volt, really, in the real analog world, the best thing that you're really going to do is maybe 16. It's kind of hard at 24 bits, but the reason why they're making these converters that will go to 24 bits and 64 bits is because of, now what's the name of it? There's a word for it now, it's not coming out of my head. When you do, for example, let's take a Motorola DSP, let's not even talk about Blackfin. Let's talk about the Motorola 68000 series. Okay, it has a couple of registers in it. It has two registers that are 32 bits wide. And the reason why it's called a 56,000 is you can take two words, and the biggest register before you get arithmetic out.
Repeater. Time out.
We only lost about 25 seconds, but you're going to be thinking of that word. There is one place, though, I'm suddenly realizing. And by the way, we're about to switch over to answering Mel's mailbag for a little while so that we can get the people before they go to bed, the youngsters, so to speak. In the case of a digital, global positioning satellite, where the signal that you're encoding is 24 decibels below the noise, you still do an analog-to-digital conversion, and after all of the post-detection integration that goes on, you manage to suck that signal 34 dB out of the noise because it's a very specifically known signal with a spread spectrum. spectrum to it. So I can see how there are cases where you go way beyond the number of bits of analog to digital encoding, even though nowhere near the right signal-to-noise ratio is there to a naive person. And I can see how there's great value in that. There's a lot more going on here, and I've got a lot. We've all got a lot more questions for you, Eric. Thank goodness you stop in from time to time and tell us what the state of the art or the edge of the art really is. Mel, why don't you go to your mailbag and give us at least the most burning questions you had this week. I think we sort of settled last week that particular antenna we were investigating is doing most of what the advertisement says it's doing, and it's a little bit on the pricey side, but you pay your money and you take your choice. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right, a little bit more about that later on. I'll tell you what, I have found out, I was able to get a hold of one of them. One of the people listening have purchased one of them, and one of the ones that we discussed, I won't mention the name, but I will describe it in detail later on. Let us first go to the mailbag and comments I've been getting from a lot of young people that have been started their experiments on electronics. And they have already established a little work area, gotten the tools together, gotten themselves a basic BOM, have been taking resistors off the boards and making measurements, understanding how to meter read. All that has been going smoothly. I've gotten a lot of emails saying that, oh boy, this is really fascinating. And so now I'd like to just continue about another little device that's especially they questioned me on, and I know what they're talking about, of course, is the capacitors that they have found on the board and how to understand the reading of them. Because, you know, years ago, a capacitor was marked very clear, 0.01, 005, whatever it is, and voltage next to it. Let's drop that. Now, of course, things are a little different. You see things on these capacitors such as 103M, 121A, things like that. Where? What do you do with this stuff? How do you read it? How do you discern what to look for when you're going to build a project? And on the schematic, they tell you to put in a resistor of certain value. How do you find the resistor? How do you find the capacitor value? So I thought we'd delve into the modern world of the new type of capacitors that are all coming in, of course, mostly from the Far East, I assume. K2RIW and the TechNet, K2KEY. Now keep it simple, Vic. We've got young people involved.
Okay. I'm trying to think now of all the capacitors I've used. Everything was used in the picofarad region. In other words, the smallest capacitor I have used in the last 5 years on surface mount components was 0.1 picofarad. And the largest thing I probably used at a gigahertz, I guess, was around 300 picofarad. When it comes to markings like 103 mic and 121 kilo, I haven't seen those markings. My first guess with 103 mic would be M for million, and that would be millions of picofarads. So 1 0, three more zeros, and I could work from picofarads back into what is the real capacitance. But here I'm making some guesses. You're going to have to help me on this one, Mel. What does 103 mic stand for and 121 kilo stand for? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, let me repeat you, Scrapshot. Right, 103 would be 10 and 30. That would be approximately, 10,000 pico. So we went ahead and we were translating back into the language that you and I grew up with. We would be looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah, I made a guess. It looks like I was right. So 103, if I had a 103 by way of color code, that would be a 10,000 ohm resistor. Assuming now that everything on surface mount components on most of the brand names tends to be in units of picofarad, 10 to the minus 12 farads. That would be 10,000 picofarads. And if I move the decimal place six places over, I would get 0.01 microfarad. So a disc ceramic capacitor of 0.01 microfarad, or the tubular paper capacitors that were waxed on the outside that you and I used in the old days, 0.01 microfarad as an audio coupling capacitor, a very popular value. Nowadays, I think you're telling me it's in a tiny little surface mount component, probably a 603, in other words, 60 thou by 30 thou. Most of these surface mount components, let me drop them.
Oh, not surface mount, but...
Okay, I've been using surface mount, so you're telling me now this is an actual lead capacitor, but it's mount, okay, 103, I could look at it as 103M for microfarad, which it is absolutely not, I don't, although it could be. I think you're telling me in most cases it's picofarad, so that is 10,000 picofarad, which when you move the decimal place six places, you're converting from picofarads to microfarads, one of the most popular units used, and that would be 0.01 microfarad. So far, does that sound approximately right, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW, and the TechNet?
Exactly. Yeah, 103M, now the M. These are the ones that you will find on the older boards now. This is not surface mounted because I told them, find the old VCRs, you know, going back 10, 15 years ago, television sets, you know, plenty of that stuff in the street. And take that apart, and you can unsolder, you can do a lot of things with that, which you can't, you know, do today with the surface mount stuff. I mean, we can't jump into that at this point. Talk about components that they can use for making little projects that appear in the manuals and all day. These are like circuits that will appear, you know, circuits or oscillators or cold practice oscillator or some goddamn thing like that, where they use simple components. And these are the proper, you know, components that you can handle. So let's stay away from, you know, they're not going to make print circuits. They make them mostly maybe on vector board or point-to-point wiring, you know, just tie your leads together and something. So just to get used to handling. So the 103, I should say the M. The M is the tolerance. They stick the tolerance on their own. And I think you can more or less let that go for the time being. You'll see sometimes an M, sometimes a K written on there. But okay, let's take now, if you see something like, instead of, we just mentioned 103M, let's leave that the M off. Just 103 would mean 10,000 pico or 0.01. Now, you may see something like, we'll say, 121, 121. Now, what does that 121 mean? 121 would mean that the 1, the 1, 2 would be 1, 2, and then 0. So, in other words, this would be 120 TF. The 1 stands for a 0 digit, actually. So, if you see something with like 121, that will be 120 pico. Go ahead, Dick.
And when it comes to RF circuits, 120 picofarads, 121 marking, 1, 2, and one more zero, the third digit of the color coding system usually is the number of zeros you add to the first two digits. And occasionally there are precision resistors that have more digits than that. We won't go there right now. When it comes to testing a capacitor on a volt ohm milliammeter, just to get a vague idea that it is approximately working, it's not a short circuit or not an open circuit. Because there is a universal law, let me drop. There's a universal law that you cannot change the voltage instantaneously on a capacitor. You have to pour current into the capacitor for some length of time. It integrates that voltage and comes up with a certain final voltage reading, so to speak. And by the way, one of the questions that we hear periodically on the TechNet is, what in the world are you guys talking about? And the best I can suggest along those lines is that if you sit and listen, the foreign terms you hear will eventually start making sense. You can tell that Mel and I flip back and forth between some relatively deep deep stuff, particularly when we're talking to modern broadcast technology. And we're having a conversation with Eric KE2EJ, who is the chief engineer of PBS channels 21 and 13 locally in the New York City area. Well, he's telling us the kind of hardware he's using and the big bucks he spends for those pieces of test equipment, and what makes that transmitter transmit that very elaborate digital advanced television selection committee signal. He's using all kinds of vocabulary that the rest of us have very rarely heard. Mel and I also periodically try to give a little bit of instruction to the people who are just starting out. We flip back and forth between the two. Try not to get frustrated. Brand new information is always going to be a little difficult to understand at first. But we study, listen with a period of time. In that crazy example I gave last week, if somebody airdropped you into the middle of China and you had no way of getting back out of the country for a year, after that year you would learn some of the local culture, some of the local language. You'd be able to find a bathroom, a cafeteria, and things like that, if you know what I mean. You know how to ask for where's the food, where can I sleep, and so on. You would learn that just by being exposed to it. So that's the best I can recommend. Don't be frustrated. You're in very good company if some of the stuff doesn't make sense to you. But let me drop. But now the way a volt ohm milliammeter works in the ohm meter mode, and you can select whether it's the times 1, the times 10, the times 100, the times 1,000, and so on. You're setting the scale of the ohm meter. And what you're really doing is you're setting a series resistor between the internal battery and the meter and the two probes going to the outside world. So what the ohm meter is trying to do, in the case of the old-fashioned volt-ohm milliammeters, some of them are trying to try to put 3 volts across your circuit. The really old vacuum tube voltmeters used to have, I think, a pair of C-cells in there. Some of them have only 1 C-cell, and they only put 1.5 volts. So the meter is attempting to put 1.5 volts across its 2 probes. And if it does see 1.5 volts, which is the same as the internal battery, no current flows, the meter doesn't move. A direct short circuit, once you select a particular scale, chooses a particular current, and the meter moves a certain amount. And depending on what your external resistor is, your meter moves an amount telling you the right number of ohms once you multiply it by the scale. You put that volt-ohm milliammeter in the appropriate ohm meter scale, particularly the higher scales when you're trying to measure a capacitor. And if you put your 2 probes across your particular capacitor, and if the needle eventually settles down at, let me pick a number, 10 million ohms, that means that your capacitor has no internal short circuit, and it's doing a beautiful job of charging up to the internal voltage of your volt-ohm milliammeter. That's how the needle goes back down to the left-hand side, so to speak. Now, if I put something like a 0.1 microfarad capacitor across a times a million scale on the volt-ohm milliammeter,
repeater, timeout, cancel,
you will see the needle jump over toward 0 ohms and slowly charge up. You're watching the capacitor being charged by the volt-ohm milliammeter. Depending on what scale you're on and how fast the needle is moving, you will eventually learn that this is a poor man's way of measuring microfarads. That needle will move at a particular rate depending on microfarads. If I was measuring a 100 microfarad capacitor, you would watch it charge up very slowly unless you went to a lower multiplier scale. If I'm only measuring a 0.1 microfarad capacitor, you'll see it move a lot more rapidly. The rate at which the needle moves is giving you a strong indication of what is the size of that capacitor in picofarads or microfarads. That technique on tantalum or electrolytic capacitors works extremely well. When you get down to numbers like 100 picofarad, I think the technique fails because the needle now is just taking a jump so briefly that you probably will not be able to catch it. So I think this capacitor charging technique on a volt-ohm milliammeter in the ohm meter scale, I believe it works very well for numbers like 0.1 microfarad and larger, but for the numbers smaller than that, I think it starts to fail. Beyond, for smaller numbers than 0.01 microfarad, I think it probably doesn't work. You probably have some opinions on this one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah. You know, it's a funny joke, but a lot of times I used it in 50, I used to use it on the bench, and people, you know, more, much younger people that work in the place, you know, stand there, and I'd be checking things and all, and I'd go, oh, this is okay, this is okay. They said, didn't even see this. What do you mean it's okay? I hardly saw the needle move. So I always used to say to my feet, wait, you know, getting ready to move, that this device is or bed or whatever, so... I could say this is from the old days. All right, Mark here. Let me stay with the subject here. Young fellow by the name of Mark. Okay, Mark. He found a capacitor that's marked 4R7. What does that mean? Okay. When you see the letter R, it means a point of dot, period, whatever you want, decimal point. Okay? So if you see that a part marked 4R7 that you took off the board, that means it's 4.7 picofarad. 4.7. That's what the dot stands for. It's a way of saying decimal point. There's also one piece of equipment that Ronnie took apart, and he's got other designations with a P in there. Okay, now, what's the P mean? He's got one that's marked 1P8, and one, what else is he marked here? 6P8. All right, why the P now? The P, let me drop it. The Chinese, the Japanese, and all, they stick to this type of thing with things like R for decimal point. However, the Europeans use a P. So he had an 8P2. What does that mean? That means 8.2 pico. In this case, the P is the decimal point, but they use P. But European manufacturers of the stuff that's sending in are using P. Oh, I'm telling you, I know it's confusing as all hell, I'm sure, Dick, over.
Yes, it is. In the case of surface mount resistors, I have seen things like you were mentioning before, 4R7, which would be 4.7 ohms of resistance. Sometimes they use the R as a decimal point on a surface mount very small resistor. On some transistorized circuits, when you have an emitter biasing resistor, you do run into numbers that are very low like that. However, if you have a doubt as to whether or not the component you're looking at is a 4.7 ohm resistor or a 4.7 picofarad capacitor, your ohm meter will tell you that very rapidly. A 4.7 ohm resistor on the times 1 ohm scale, you'd recognize that real fast. A 4.7 picofarad capacitor on the highest scale you've got, the times 1 millionth scale on your ohm meter, it would look like a perfect open circuit. And that small number of picofarads, not even that very sharp eye of Mel K2KEY would be able to see that needle kick. That kind of a capacitor, he cannot measure as far as its value is concerned with his ohm meter. Let me drop. He can measure the fact that it's not shorted, the fact that it looks like an open circuit, which it should, on an ohm meter on the highest scale. But when it comes to confirming that your capacitor is 4.7 picofarad, a slightly more elaborate procedure is required, which I'm not going to go into right now. Just know that your ohm meter will not test that for you. But when it comes to 0.01 microfarad and larger, if you have an unknown capacitor and a known capacitor of close to the same value, and you watch the way your known good one kicks on its ohm meter on a particular scale. And if the kick is too fast, go to a higher multiplication scale. You'll eventually get to a scale high enough where you'll watch the needle slowly charge at a particular rate. And if you compare that rate of charge and the final value that it goes to on your known good capacitor versus your unknown capacitor, you will very rapidly confirm that it's approximately the right number of microfarads. The older wax-filled or waxed paper-type capacitors, tantalum capacitors or electrolytic capacitors, tend to dry out, tend to become much, much smaller in microfarads, don't do as good a job of filtering if they're part of a power supply. So finding out whether or not your 100 microfarad filter capacitor on a power supply, whether or not it has gone from 100 down to 1 microfarad, therefore is doing very little filtering, that is very nice to know. By disconnecting it from the circuit and watching the ohm meter kick, you'll find that one very fast. That's the kind of troubleshooting that Mel was doing when the guys around him, the younger guys, saying, what in the world are you doing? How do you know how good it is? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Young people, you should hear. I won't get into about something else I'm doing where I've been lecturing and all and working in a lab lately and what happens with trying to show people how to do safety and all. It is not an easy, I know it is not applied very much. There's not going to be any job for people who sit at a bench and do a point-to-point testing on a circuit board because it's cheap and throws the thing out. And those days have gone that I'm doing that kind of service. However, part of the curriculum of studying electrical engineer still requires some laboratory work where you familiarize yourself with the engineering and what the device looks like and how to test it. I know this is far and few between that they're ever going to have applications like. All right, one more thing. This is where also we are talking about the European system now that they have a marking that are, can drive you crazy a little bit. They put that key in, as I said, in the best and they get over like 100 pico, 100 CF, and they drop it. For some reason, they have adopted this N for Norway, N for nano, that tends to, I think, the minus 9, if I'm not mistaken. That's a whole other thing that'll drive you crazy. That once that they're marked, the device with an N on it, meaning nano, over.
Yeah, for the guys who are listening, you'll hear a little bit of noise in the background on me, and you'll hear a lot more noise in the background on Mark. Because there is a storm going through New York City right now, and therefore there's a lot of wind at the site of this repeater station, and the antenna is being waved back and forth in the wind, you're hearing a lot of local static crashes. The electronics of the way a single-site repeater works is that if the wind blows hard enough and moves all of the hardware around that's on the rooftop where the repeater is located, you'll hear a lot of staticky noise. It's called the rusty nail problem. Anything you can do to aim a little more signal or go to a little higher power Mel, would help because your signal does have a fair amount of noise on it from the static crashes of the wind blowing the antenna at the repeater site. And Mel has one other disadvantage, and that is, let me drop. This repeater shares a frequency with Frenchtown, New Jersey, and Torrington, Connecticut. And they have intentionally made a slight null in the antenna pattern in the direction of Frenchtown, New Jersey, so as not to give interference to those guys who use their local repeater on the exact same frequency. Well, Mel lives in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, which just happens to be in that exact azimuth setting where there's a slight notch in the antenna pattern. So although Mel is radiating quite a bit more power than I am right now, still because he's in the undesirable portion of the antenna pattern, and even though he's closer to the repeater than I am, you hear quite a bit more noise on his signal. In the United States, getting back to what Mel was just saying, in the United States, almost all of our markings are either in microfarads or picofarads. Let me drop. The word farad is a method of measuring the size of a capacitor. But unfortunately, a farad is an extremely big number.